You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, March 18th, 2009, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
And it was March 20th in 1916 when Albert Einstein's theory of general relativity was published, first published.
I remember that.
Awesome.
It's a good time.
That's better than that special theory of relativity.
Yeah. That weak paper he wrote. But this one delivered
the goods.
Did you guys
ever hear that, I don't know if it's a rumor or, you know, a myth of Einstein on his deathbed and he was saying something in German and the nurse couldn't speak German? Did you ever hear that?
I heard it, and I'm skeptical.
I'm pretty skeptical of that, too. It is a myth, Steve?
Yeah.
I know what he said, by the way.
Giving the final answer to the theory of everything, yeah. And the nurse didn't understand what he was saying.
He was never close enough to that.
He said, Rosebud.
Oh, I heard that he said that God does play dice.
He does, and he wins.
He probably said, I'd give you the theory for everything, but I don't have enough room in the margin.
Right. He says one.
You're stepping
Thank you,
on my air hose.
Du bist mein air hosen gesteppen. He said, Soylent Green is people.
But those deathbed conversion stories always crop up. And this was the worst one. They even tried to spread that rumor about Carl Sagan.
Oh man!
I mean, come on! Talk about stretching credulity.
Yeah, and what did they say he said, Steve?
That at the end he believed in God. You know.
Uh huh.
Darwin is a very popular one too, which is also wrong.
So we have Phil Plait joining us later in the show to talk about some astronomy items, but first some other news items. The Pope recently made some interesting statements about the use of condoms for the prevention of HIV. When I wrote about this, I said that I don't care if the Pope has a moral position or the Catholic Church has a moral position on the use of condoms. That's what religions do. They have moral positions. But he came out and made some specific scientific claims that were completely wrong. And just the easily verifiable facts that he got terribly wrong. He said that the use of condoms actually might increase the risk of HIV. And that was later supported by the Vatican, talking about the fact that, you know, there are tiny holes in condoms and that the virus is a lot smaller than a sperm and the viruses can pass through it. When in fact, the evidence clearly shows that the use of condoms reduces the risk of spreading HIV by 90%. So, yeah, it's not 100%, nothing is, but it is 90% effective. So now, he was actually in Africa when he made this statement, part of the world that is undergoing an HIV epidemic, and decided to subjugate the scientific facts to his moral position. Always a bad play in my book.
And Steve, I have to actually disagree with you a bit. You said it wouldn't be a problem if he was just taking a moral position. I totally disagree. I think that in a case like this, even if he's not coming out and make it a scientific fact about condoms and their ability to prevent the spread of AIDS, if he's still instructing millions of people to stop using condoms for any reason, that's morally reprehensible. And I think that we have to stand up against something like that when, you know, I think that in and of itself goes against science and reason and needs to be combated.
Well, to be fair, the position, as I understand it, is that that people should abstain from sex until they're married and then be monogamous within their marriage. That's their position. And that's the most effective way to prevent the spread of HIV, which if people actually did that, it would be. And saying that people should do that is purely a moral position. It's not, you know, scientific or even ethical. It's just a
but it's also
moral choice.
Unbelievably unrealistic.
That's a separate issue. You know, that's sort of the abstinence-only training. I mean, to say that that's an effective program, that's a separate claim. But to say that that's what he would prefer people to do according to the faith, the Catholic faith, fine. I have no problem with that. But
I do have a problem.
He went
with
beyond
that.
Saying that, you know, if you're not going to do that, I mean, he wasn't really saying this, but this is the implications of what he said. If you're not going to be monogamous or abstain until you're married, still don't use a condom. I don't think they say that. They say don't do that. They say be monogamous and abstain.
All right, so what if I don't plan on getting married and I want to have sex with multiple partners?
But that's what they say you shouldn't do, right?
Yeah,
that's what the position is.
Now, if I want to do that, then I can't be a Catholic. I can't go to, no Jesus for me. What's happening?
I don't know. I don't know that you're going to get excommunicated over that, but that certainly is against their teaching.
Hey, Rebecca, let's get excommunicated.
I think you have to be communicated first.
Yeah, that requires a lot of work to get into the church first.
I'm not communicated.
Really, you might be.
Yeah. Since when do you have to be communicated before you can get excommunicated? I got all the communication going on, man.
See, I'm Baptist, and they don't have they don't kick you out.
They don't cast you into the outer darkness and declare you anathema.
No, they just give you
cast into the outer darkness so bad.
They give you stern looks if you dance and drink.
Jay, it gets boring after a while.
Yeah. All right, but for real though, is there like, when you're excommunicated, does that only work for like people that become bishops and stuff? Or
no, anyone who is a member of the Catholic Church can be excommunicated.
Excommunication is for serious crimes in their eyes. For instance, in the story that's been hitting the news big lately has been the girl in Brazil who's 9 years old, raped by her stepfather, impregnated with twins, and after a few weeks they decided that those twins, she wouldn't be able to give birth to them because she was so tiny. And so they aborted the twins with her mother's permission. The Catholic Church excommunicated the doctors and the mother who agreed to have the twins aborted. And they did not excommunicate the stepfather of the girl who raped her. The Vatican defended the decision, saying that it was a crime worthy of excommunication when you have an abortion or when you actually perform an abortion, but it is not a sin worthy of excommunication when you rape a 9-year-old child.
Of course not.
So they have their own special set of rules that don't actually make much sense in a current modern society. So to say, it's difficult to say what they'll excommunicate you for, but I don't think they would excommunicate you for having sex outside of marriage. That would just require you going to the priest and begging forgiveness. However, the begging of forgiveness will not actually cure your AIDS. So
that's where
the problem comes in.
Getting back to the condom thing, though, just to finish that story, the other point I wanted to make was that there was a representative of the Vatican, I believe their health advisor or something, that did make a statement if a wife's husband was HIV positive, that in that case, the use of a condom would be appropriate self-defense for her, against the advances of her husband, or that would be the lesser evil in that case. Still an evil, but maybe a lesser evil. But then that was contradicted by the Pope's statement.
Yeah, it's completely irresponsible for the Pope or anyone, any higher up with the Catholic Church, to come out against condoms in any way, especially in Africa. I mean, it's, it's not quite as bad as, letting the rapist of a 9-year-old go off scot-free, but it's up there. You're basically contributing to the deaths of millions, and it's really kind of depressing that they would take that stance.
Yeah, I think, just from a logical point of view, the thing that strikes me about these kind of things is that when you have a moral position, you shouldn't twist the scientific facts to be in line with your moral choice, because that's always going to bite you in the ass in the end. Because either, if you are wrong, it's gonna people will dismiss your moral opinion, and also you'll be committing malfeasance. In this case, you may be condemning people to HIV because you're giving them false information. You're better off just saying, listen, they may work, but we're still against them on moral grounds. At least you're being consistent. You still may object to their moral stance, but at least that's a better strategy than actually trying to lie about the science in order to support your position.
Because now I'm thinking about this, and obviously we're talking.
She's thinking, guys. She's thinking.
I'm thinking. Everybody, back up.
No,
I believe that my problem with the moral stance in general is that I don't believe that morals exist in a vacuum. God didn't just give them to mankind, and there you go. Our morals are based upon facts and evidence. And rational people base their morals upon facts and evidence. Obviously, the society that you're raised in has a ton to do with your own morals. However, when it comes down to it, when you're really examining why you believe a certain way, you should fall back on the facts. And when it comes to condom usage, the facts say that having sex before marriage is not a bad thing. It's not a terrible thing. There's no fact to support that it is. And therefore, using a condom, especially in a region like Africa, where AIDS is rampant, makes sense. And also, even if you're in a marriage and you're with someone, the chances are, you know, you're in this region where there's a very good chance that your partner, even if that's going to be your partner for the rest of your life, there's a very good chance that he might have AIDS. Maybe he's even taken a test and you know he has AIDS. Or she. Yes. And, you know, and so in that case, there, it shouldn't even be a case of morals. It's not a lesser or greater evil to tell a woman that she should use a condom if her husband has AIDS or vice versa. Morals should, like these God-given morals that seem to exist in a vacuum should not even come into the equation. And the fact that they do is a net loss for humanity, and they should not exist. We should base our decisions on rational thinking. And
of course,
I guess that's my issue with the moral stance.
Rebecca, you're going to hate this because I'm going to add this to my list of Pope science that we've been accumulating on this podcast over the years. And here's the list as it stands right now. Some things are Pope Benedict has said since he's become Pope. Science has narrowed the way life's origins are understood. The Darwinist theory of evolution is not completely provable because mutations over hundreds of thousands of years cannot be reproduced in a laboratory. God created life through evolution. The trial of Galileo for heresy because of his support for the Copernican system was justified in the context of the time. Saving humanity from homosexual or transsexual behavior was just as important as saving the rainforest from destruction.
Oh, my God.
The contraceptive pill is polluting the environment and is in part responsible for male infertility. And embryonic stem cell research, artificial insemination, and the prospect of human cloning have shattered human dignity.
Right. And these are, you know, those are moral stances. And you mentioned homosexuality, I think, is another very good example of a so-called moral stance where they've decided that homosexuality is wrong, and that's their moral stance. And there is not a shred of evidence to prove that there's anything wrong with being a homosexual. There's nothing wrong. And in fact, we see in nature, you know, we see bonobos getting it on all the time. Female bonobos go at it, and guess what? They're doing all right.
Yeah, but
they're les bonobos.
So, Rebecca, I have to disagree with you on a couple of points.
Okay.
And I think that you're mixing arguments of ethics and morals, and also facts and value judgments. So you could make a distinction between ethics, which is a system of behavior, of deciding what's right and wrong based upon reason and knowledge and facts, and an internally consistent logical system that can be applied broadly and universally. You could make an argument for why people shouldn't kill other people. You don't have to have faith or a belief system. We can come up, you know, based upon first principles, we can arrive upon ethics that we can all agree upon are reasonable and base our laws and our society on that. Morals, however, are things that people choose for themselves, and they involve sometimes naked value judgments. Value judgments are just that. They are not. They might be informed by facts or by logic or reason, but they don't have to be, and they are personal choices. Here's an example of where I think you get into trouble when you mix this, is you kind of might fall prey to the same kind of fallacy in that, like, for example, you said that there's nothing wrong scientifically, factually with homosexuality. There's no downside to being a homosexual. What if there were? What if the science just turned out that there was some negative thing to being a homosexual? I think we could still make the ethical decision that human dignity demands that people have the right to their own sexual preference and to not be interfered with. The facts don't have to support ethical decisions that we think are correct. the facts are what they are, and we shouldn't mix the two or demand that the facts support our ethics or say that they derive entirely from scientific facts free of value judgments, because they don't. We still have to be allowed to make those value judgments, and I think that's a very critical distinction to make. Of course, I agree with the specific positions you're taking, but that's a different point. Do you understand that?
I admit that I am not that well versed on morals versus ethics, despite the fact that I took a class called ethics in college. That was a while ago. can you give me an example of a moral decision that you as a rational person would make that is not based on scientific fact?
Well, I don't make arbitrary moral decisions that for me personally, right? I personally don't do that. I try to.
But you think that it, but you but I, say but that other it's people okay have, for others.
I'm not saying it's okay. I'm saying other people have the right to do that. You know, okay, it's a kind of a too vague of a statement. Because we have, for here's the example. If someone says they, just to take a very benign example, someone says, I believe that you should not have sex outside of marriage. That's my personal morality. I think it's important because I value whatever that is, because I think that the God that I believe in wants me to do that, or I think that that's a virtue, that that is the way one should lead their life. They don't have to have – I'm not saying it's scientifically a better way to go or that there's any specific advantage to it. That's just a personal moral decision I make for myself. I don't care if someone else makes that moral decision for themselves.
Okay, I'll agree with that then. I agree that every person has the right to decide.
Right. But
that
ethics,
sort of thing.
Just to finish that thought, ethics would be saying that we should make a law saying it's illegal for people to get to have sex before marriage, because you can derive from first principles an ethical argument that says that it's wrong, it exploits or something, whatever. There is some moral hazard involved there. That would be a completely separate argument, type of argument to make. So with the Pope, for example, if he wants to say that according to the Catholic faith, we do not believe in sex outside of marriage, and therefore that's the only solution that we're going to endorse to sexually transmitted disease, I don't care if he says that. But if he starts to say that, you know, that to marshal incorrect scientific facts to support that essentially religious belief, then that's what I have a problem with.
There's a chance I still don't understand, just because what I'm thinking right now is, yes, I agree that any person has the right to say, I don't believe in sex before marriage, whatever. But when that person happens to be the Pope and is broadcasting their morals to millions of other people, that at that point it becomes irresponsible and ready for criticism.
I agree with that. Being in a leadership position brings new moral obligations to bear. I will agree with you on that.
Okay. Common ground. Handshake. Hugs.
It's a complicated issue. It's a kind of
it is.
But
yeah.
It's interesting to talk about. But let's move on to the next news item. Bob, this is about as different as what we were talking about as you can get. You're going to tell us about the 20th anniversary of the World Wide Web.
Yes. Does everyone know who Tim Berners-Lee is?
He invented the World Wide Web.
Oh, you... I forgot. I felt
that
ashamed
was
that I forgot. Yeah, right? I forgot who what this guy's name was. And we really should never forget who this guy is, because it's really quite an amazing thing he did 20 years ago.
What was his
this
name again?
Month, Tim Berners-Lee, March 13th, 1989. He was working at CERN, and he went to his boss, Mike Sendell, and he gave him a proposal. And his boss described it as vague but exciting. So his idea, of course, was the World Wide Web. And it's interesting to point out, you remember all the big hubbub about the Large Hadron Collider last year? The LHC was actually partly responsible for the World Wide Web, because back in the 80s, they were actually preparing for the LHC, and they were talking about it and having meetings. And he was saying that at the end of every meeting, somebody would say, yes, but how will we ever keep track of such a large project? So dealing with the vast amount of information that needed to be shared among so many different people was really concerned Berners-Lee, and this is what prompted him to write his now seminal proposal that really really changed so much of everyone's daily lives on the entire planet. Now, what he did in this proposal, in it he wrote that This paper discusses the problems of loss of information about complex evolving systems and derives a solution based on distributed hypertext system. He also presciently realized that the needs of CERN were going to be duplicated in the world at large. He said that CERN is a model in miniature of the rest of the world in a few years' time. So he realized that CERN needed this tool, this technology, but he said he realized that the world is getting so complicated that it would be an invaluable tool in the future. Now, I mentioned hypertext. I'm sure you guys have heard of hypertext before. Yeah, it's a pretty common term. Now, he didn't. You might think he.
Oh, wait, that's a hypertext.
Yeah, right. You might think that he invented that, but he didn't. That idea has been kicking around since the 1960s. So it's pretty common, the idea that you've got a document of text that contains these hyperlinks. That links you to other information that could be that you can immediately hop from link to link, and the links could bring you to computers on information on computers on the other side of the planet. Now, it should be noted that people really, when they think of the World Wide Web, they really sometimes they confuse it with the Internet itself, and they really are kind of two distinct things. The Internet was around for 15 years before the Web. It was created by Al Gore and all that stuff, but
they have the internet on computers now.
But public perception back then was pretty weird. People kind of saw it really. The internet is like corporate email, or it's really the domain of nerds. You got these pimply nerds, and they go to their bulletin boards and stuff, and they really didn't think too much about it. And the problem was, back then, the internet wasn't browsable. There was actually quite a lot of information available on the internet back then, but it was very hard to get to. I remember before browsers came out in the early 90s, I went to a local college and I tried to get on the internet. I had been reading about the internet for years, and I wanted to get on this thing and check it out. I tried for like a half hour, and it was just these arcane commands you had to go through, and I gave up. I just walked away from it and said, I can't do it.
I remember that when my dad worked in IT, and we had a 386, and he had told me all about the internet. I was so excited. He said, you can access a library on the other side of the world. I thought that was the coolest thing ever. And then he loads it up, and it's just some, green text on the black screen, and I'm like, what? No, this sucks, actually. I couldn't figure it out. It was not the wonderland of unicorns and lolcats that has become now.
No, but it certainly has become that, and it's largely because of the World Wide Web and the advent of the browsers, of course, that kind of like the World Wide Web took these kind of complicated tools like FTP and Telnet that you had to become a master of to really get to the information on the internet. It kind of took those tools, those protocols, and kind of buried them under the surface so that you didn't really need to know the ins and outs of doing that. The browser just lets you use your mouse and point and click, and this stuff is done on behind the scenes, and it's just so easy to find information, and that's what really made it take off when you finally had these browsers, these powerful browsers that became really popular, and you put that on top of the incorporated that into the web, then the amount of nodes that were available, the web servers that were available, just exploded exponentially. It was quite amazing.
The tubes came in?
Intertubes.
Yeah. Started connecting the tubes. It's basically a series of them.
Right.
Bob, do you know who coined the phrase a World Wide Web?
This guy did.
Which guy?
Tim Berners-Lee. Tim Berners-Lee.
Oh, I forgot his name.
He came up with
Yeah, you just said it. I already forgot.
Jay, the first program he wrote that really was a little mini website was called it the World Wide Web. That was the name of the program.
So now, the WWW probably came from that name.
That's correct.
Yeah, I think so. It can't just be a coincidence. Now, hey, it's also – thanks for reminding me, Jay. It's also important to note after he wrote the proposal, this guy came up with all the protocols, the HTTP, that's in every web address that you've ever seen, Hypertext Transfer Protocol. He came up with that.
And who's the guy
– HTML.
Who came up with the idea of calling it, of saying WWW instead of World Wide Web? Because World Wide Web is three syllables. WWW,
that's nine.
Who came up with that? I'd like to punch that guy.
Right? You know what I've heard, Rebecca? I've heard somebody on some podcast saying dub, dub, dub.
So that's I believe that Stephen Fry, I think, came up with that, I suspect.
Or W3. But so also this guy came up with things like HTTP, the Hypertext Transfer Protocol. He came up with URL, Uniform Resource Locator. That's what a web address is. It's not, you know, it's not a phone number, Biden. It's it's a URL. It's an address. And an HTML. My God, hypertext markup language. Where would the web have been without that? So these are amazing things that this guy came up with.
Oh my God, that blows my mind. That one person came up with all of those.
Yeah, he came up with that stuff. But keep in mind that he didn't come up with the idea of hypertext. That was other people before him. And he was also building this on top of the internet. You know, so the web is kind of like the best internet killer app. But it was still the internet was there. You know. So he was standing on the shoulders of giants, but look at some of these internet reviews I came across from the early 90s. Time Magazine, 1994, was arguing that the internet would never go mainstream. It said that it was not designed for doing commerce, and it does not gracefully accommodate new arrivals.
Yeah, and look where Newsweek, Time Magazine is now, in the crapper.
Newsweek was very pithy in February 1995.
Them
the
too.
Headline they had was, "The Internet? Bah!" That's all. Yeah, right. That's what the title of the headline.
Yeah. Well, gee, print media's dead.
The internet is the internet turned out to be threats to both of those magazines, and is total. Mm. And you know, magazines are now shadows of their former selves.
Yeah, but nobody back in the 90s was seeing where the internet could go and where it is today. Nobody was that prescient to say that it was going to change the face of communication and online shopping and business models and publishing.
Porn.
Nobody,
I would say
of course.
Nobody, Bob. It was just those of us who happened to be 13-year-old girls who were still kind of excited to see where it was going. Like, despite the fact that it was just some text on a screen and very disappointing to me at first, because in my head I had pictured grand palaces of information. As soon as browsers came along, I was sold, you know, and I was there wasn't a doubt in my mind that that was the future. So
yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
absolutely!
Sure. I think the stodgy old people didn't get it, but
but the true extent, you know, in the early 90s, I think what I said holds that in the early 90s, nobody really could have foreseen what it would bring about the full extent. I mean, there were glimmers, but the full extent, and I don't think we even see it yet. You know, it's still coming. There's still things coming along the line. Like Berners-Lee's working. His big thing now is the semantic web, where you're basically making the websites machine readable. So the internet or the web itself is machine readable, which some people have been calling Web 3.0. He's been trying to get that off the ground for a bunch of years now. And if it works out, we'll see another renaissance.
What does that mean by machine readable?
It's basically the language, the markup language that you use would be detailed enough so that a computer can go onto a website and know what the website is all about, and know that, all right, this website has a database of this type of information. It would know things like what a zip code is,
right.
And it would be able to understand it not at an AI level, but it would at a level that would transform the internet in such a way that it could be truly amazing if we could really understand what's going on with this website. So imagine the queries and what Google would be like if Google really understood what's on these web pages.
So Google ads wouldn't be serving up, you know, pro acupuncture advertising on my blog post where I'm trashing acupuncture.
Right, absolutely.
Right, that's what the
or it would. Maybe the AI will have a sense of humor.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
Okay.
Oh, the other quick thing here that Tim Berners-Lee and lots of other people, and I guess it's pretty obvious, the future of the web is phone web, getting the World Wide Web on cell phones. We're seeing it now, and he thinks it's just going to explode, and it needs to explode because 80% of the population does not surf the web. I mean, can you believe that?
Really?
80% of the world still doesn't surf
the
web.
Oh, the world. Yeah, you're talking about the world.
Yeah, 80% right, of the world can't eat on a regular basis.
It's true that it might be true that 80% of the world doesn't surf the web, but how many of those people have phones? You give them phones, it's a lot more than 20%, I'll tell you that. If you give everyone who has a cell phone access to the web, and bam, you just knock down that 80%.
And also, I think one of the most exciting things is stuff like one laptop per child, which gives people the ability to form networks of their own that leap from computer to computer. And those computers are specifically designed to be very capable of picking up Wi-Fi signals and right, connecting with one another on a level that like even my laptop can't do. So I think stuff like that is going to help pave the way and help connect the developing world to the internet.
Yeah, we're still right smack dab in the middle of an incredible change in terms of the way we access information and do business. So thanks for that, Bob. One more news item. There's been a bit of a kerfuffle over the Canada Science Minister.
I think kerfuffle is good for anything happening in Canada.
Yeah,
that would be an uproar elsewhere.
I specifically chose the word kerfuffle because this is happening in Canada. That's right. So this started when Gary Goodyear, who is the Minister of State for Science and Technology, the Minister of Science for Canada, who happens to be a chiropractor, was asked by a reporter if he believes in evolution. And he declined to answer that question.
Strike two.
Which, of course, answers the question.
He said that, "I'm not going to answer that question.
On the grounds that it'll make me look stupid.
I am a Christian, and I don't think anybody asking a question about my religion is appropriate."
Oh, how about your science?
That's a religious question?
Right. Well, that was,
that's
the kerfuffle.
That's the sad thing, yeah.
So he was, then there was this incredible backlash because, excuse me, you're the Minister of Science. You were asked your opinion about one of the central theories of biology, of science, of modern science, and you don't think it's appropriate for you to answer that question? Of course, the question was asked under suspicions that the guy's a creationist.
And a quack.
And he's since just today, Wednesday, the 18th, he came out and clarified that he believes in evolution.
Here it comes.
But he's still waffling a bit. He says he was on an interview on CTV's Power Play, and he said, "Of course I do believe in evolution, but it's an irrelevant question. We are evolving every year, every decade." And he went on to give some examples from his experience as a chiropractor.
I'm growing a third eye.
And I quote, "That's a fact. Whether it's to the intensity of the sun, whether it's to walking on cement versus anything else, whether it's running shoes or high heels, of course we are evolving to our environment. But that's not relevant, and that's why I refuse to answer the question." So
okay,
they need
to fire that guy right now.
Yes.
Right. Yeah, so first he says, "Yes, I do believe in evolution," and everybody goes, "Whew." And then he goes on talking and proves that he has no idea what evolution is.
Right.
And once again, everyone is terrified. He seems to think that evolution means somehow all of a sudden getting used to wearing sneakers, which
Right. Flabbergasted.
Constantly evolving every day. Oh, my God.
You would think all of his...
It's people like this guy, and I'm going to say it. I don't care. This jackass, that guy's a jackass. It's people like him that get into positions like that, that screw things up.
I want to know who hired him.
Yeah, how did that guy get through any kind of process where they're like, "So, tell us about your science education. So, by the way, tell us about the things that interest you most about science and education, and, give us reasons why we would want to put you in that position."
Yeah, it's ridiculous. I mean, clearly, the Minister of Science has an important role to play in Canada in what the science agenda is, what kind of things get funded, etc. You would think that having a working knowledge of science would be important. I mean, a science nerd needs to be in that position. Somebody who loves science, who fully understands it across many disciplines, and who could make the decisions about, what kind of science is worthy, is legitimate, should be funded, etc. This guy clearly doesn't have the chops to deal with that. If he can't even present a cogent answer to his position with respect to evolution. And of course, just trying to characterize whether or not one accepts the evidence for evolution as a religious question is completely absurd. That right there is a huge red flag. That's all you really need to know right there.
Mm-hmm. Everything else is just little details. That one statement.
Look at it like this. Let's put it into perspective, okay? Like, we're talking about evolution. You know, totally proven, documented, incredible amount of proof that evolution exists. You might as well have asked this guy, so tell us what you think about gravity.
Yeah.
And
how about just his own discipline? Let's talk a little bit about chiropractic and see what kind of science he can offer up.
Well, be careful.
He can offer up for his chiropractor.
We do have two, maybe three skeptical chiropractors who listen to the podcast.
Right.
Well, I understand.
There's a chance, maybe he's one of the good guys.
At least you're dealing with what the man supposedly knows is his profession. And I think you can get a clearer idea of where this how scientifically literate this person is to see where he stands on his area of expertise.
Mike, take care of this guy.
He clearly doesn't belong in that position. Now, of course, the intelligent design buffoons are going to say, oh, he's being expelled, and it's a witch hunt against this guy because he won't kowtow to the Darwinist dogma. You know the crap that they're going to say.
Yeah.
But because the central theme there is that they confuse quality control with censorship. No, it's not censorship. It's not that you have to it's heresy if you don't believe in evolution. It's that evolution is a well-established scientific theory with a mountain of evidence behind it. And if you have a problem with evolution, then there is something wrong with your scientific understanding, or you are someone who places ideology above science.
Thank you. Steve, you said it perfectly.
And that is not the kind of person you want to have in a science. There's the minister of science.
The minister of science.
You know, the Pope thing earlier on tonight, that tweaked me a little bit. This is now I'm just pissed off.
Jenny McCarthy for Surgeon General.
Right? That's almost as bad.
Oh, my gosh.
Don't even say that. Rebecca, you know, don't even put that out there, man.
I know. It's actually already somewhere, somehow, an online petition has already begun.
Dr. McCarthy, it hurts when I do this. Well, what do your mommy instincts tell you?
My mommy instincts and my double D's tell me, don't do that.
A couple of my neurons just committed suicide.
Steve. They had a suicide pact, Steve.
Right. Each other. Joining us now is Phil Plait. Phil, welcome back to the Skeptics Guide.
Hey, thanks for having me on, especially more than once. It's pretty rare these days. Yeah.
And
this has got to be number 6 or so for you.
We stopped counting.
Yeah.
Double digits, I thought.
So for everyone who may not know, Phil is the Bad Astronomer, author of the ridiculously popular Bad Astronomy blog, which is now hosted on Discover Magazine. He's also the author of two books, Death from the Skies and Bad Astronomy. He also blogs over at Skeptic Blog, which is the official blog of the Skeptologists, which at the moment is just a pilot, but we're hoping for better things in the future. And he is the president of the James Randi Educational Foundation, with which the SGU is affiliated.
Oof. Lots of stuff.
It's getting longer and longer to introduce you.
Yeah, right.
And we're out of time. Thanks for coming, everybody.
Phil, when Bob, Steve, and I went down to see Randi at the JREF, Randi wanted to do a magic trick for us, and I randomly picked two books off the shelves, and one of them was your new book.
Wow. Totally random.
Totally randomly. Yeah.
Of course, there were only three books in the library.
Yeah, I replaced all the books in the library with mine. So.
So, Phil, let's get started just by giving us another quick plug for TAM 7, the Amazing Meeting 7, which has really evolved into the annual meeting of the skeptical movement. And that is going to be July 9th through 12th in Las Vegas. So what skeptical goodness do you have planned for us for TAM this year?
Well, we got a lot of stuff going on this year. The keynote speaker is Bill Prady, and I am like totally, totally out of control about this. He's the executive producer for The Big Bang Theory, and for those of you who don't know, shame on you. I know Rebecca doesn't watch TV; she's too busy.
But come on, no, I download things illegally all the time.
Oh, okay.
I mean, legally.
You heard it here last, folks. It's a really, really funny show about four mega physics geeks, and they're trying to get along in real life. And there's a woman who lives across the hall from them in an apartment, and she's sort of the real life person. And you know, a lot of people complain about the show because of the way it portrays geeks and this sort of thing. The thing is, you know, look, I'm a scientist and I hang out with science fiction fans and skeptics. I know my geeks, and these guys are it. I have worked or known or partied with these four guys my whole life. And so I think it's a fantastic show, and it's been getting funnier and funnier. And it's really sort of bringing geekery and nerdism into the mainstream. So I'm really excited about having Bill given the talk. He was at Comic-Con last year, and we were rolling on the floor. He was so funny. He's one of us. So it's going to be a really, really good talk. And we've got all the usual suspects, Adam Savage, Michael Shermer, Randy, I'll be there. Of course, Skeptic's Guide doing your live show in the morning. Mm-hmm. And a few surprises. We've got a talent show this year. Can you sing or juggle or, you know, play the kazoo? Then you can apply to be at the talent show and get on stage.
All at once?
If you don't mind embarrassing yourself.
Phil, I have to take slight issue. The Big Bang Theory. Okay, I did see the first few episodes, and I've heard it's changed slightly since then. But my initial problem was not with the portrayal of the geeks, but with the portrayal of the single female real person,
yeah,
as you say, who was a total idiot bimbo.
Yeah, and
in
the first
pilot
few shows were like that, and I didn't like it either. And then about halfway through the first season, they changed her character, and she became much smarter. Much more, I don't want to say settled. She's still a comic character, but a lot more sympathetic, a lot more interesting and funny. And now she's just basically mocks the guys all the time, and it's really funny.
She's the straight person.
Oh, that I like.
Yeah. It's a little bit sort of the opposite of Three's Company, when actually Chrissy Snow's character was kind of smart in the beginning, and then they made her more of a bimbo as time went on. This is the opposite of that.
I can get behind that then.
Yeah, it's tough because people start at the beginning and they should really give it a shot because after a few episodes, it's perfect.
So, Phil, part of the reason we brought you on tonight is to get us updated on the space shuttle. It's up there right now as we speak and doesn't have that many missions left. So what do you know about its current mission?
Well, this is STS-119. It's the ninth to last mission. There are only going to be eight more, I think, if I've got that number right, after this one.
How sad is that?
Not terribly.
It's gone way beyond its
schedule. Yeah,
they've
had a good run.
But we're going to have a multi-year buffer where we got to like hold out our thumbs to get into space.
Yeah, this wasn't a good plan. You know, it's like taking a cab out into the middle of nowhere and not having one ready to get to take you back. The shuttle is going to be retired next year in 2010, and then there's not going to be anything for at least 4 years. We're not going to have the Constellation program up and running. So our only access to space is going to be through the Russians or through the Europeans, a couple of other space agencies, or possibly private companies like SpaceX and those guys who SpaceX is very close to launching their big Falcon 9 rocket, which is a monster. It'll be able to take people into space, probably not for a couple of years, but it does have a man-rated capsule that they're building right now. But, you know, there's going to be a long time where we're not going to get into space, and it's going to be kind of a bummer.
Phil, when they build that spaceship, are they going to like talk to NASA and come up with an interface for the space station? Just, you know, is there like a standard for things like that?
Yeah, I think so. They're launching it at Kennedy Space Center, so they already have NASA contracts. They got hundreds of millions of dollars of NASA money to develop their rockets and their systems. So there's little doubt that these guys will be sending up supplies and people to the space station.
And Phil, do you know what they're going to do with the old shuttles? Like, are they going to be put in museums, or, you know, what would they do with those?
Amusement park rides, actually.
Awesome.
You put in a quarter, awesome, and you sit in it vibrates, and, you know, goes.
Isn't
up
there
and down
a bidding war or something going on to acquire the retired shuttles?
There were some rumors going around about being able to buy a shuttle, and I don't know how that all settled out. I'm not really sure what NASA's going to
Let's
do.
Let's check
with them.
eBay and see. No, it's not up there yet.
Yeah, that would be cool. Imagine if you made one into your house. That would be cool.
They're kind of tight. I don't know.
Hey, Phil, I've always wondered, if you go up in the shuttle, and before this is before the space station where they would spend days just in the shuttle itself, you've got the cargo bay filled. I mean, how small is the living area of the shuttle? It must be really, really tiny, isn't it?
It's not huge, but remember, they're in microgravity up there, so there's no up and down. So you
right.
know, imagine, you know, you have a 12 by 12 foot living room. Well, now it becomes a 12 by 12 by 8 foot living room. You're working with right. volume and not surface area. So it's a lot roomier than you might expect, given that it looks cramped when it's sitting on the ground.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Back to the original question, we got wandered off. The mission this time is to deliver a new truss and solar array to the space station. This is the main mission, where they're actually going to tinker toy, Lego lock this last piece onto the side of the space station. For the solar panels at least. So that's going to bring the space station up to full power, and they'll be able to have enough electricity to keep the environment running to have a full staff of 6 astronauts all the time, which is the goal. So this mission, they're billing it as bringing up the station to full power. There's still there are other things they're going to be doing. There are still missions in the future that will be bringing up more equipment, but this is really the big one because it's completing the power supply for the station.
Phil, do you have an opinion about the debate? I'm not sure how much of a debate it really is, but there are some NASA engineers that have proposed an alternate to the replacement for the shuttle that they say would be more cost-effective and more efficient. So, first of all, are you familiar with that debate going on, and do you have any opinion on it?
Well, I can't tell you if these guys have a good design or if they're full of it, but it's kind of funny sitting back and watching this because a bunch of engineers got together and said, look, NASA's taking too long and over-designing Constellation just like they did with the space station and the shuttle, and they can do this simpler and faster and cheaper. And they put this together, and they have a website, and then the story I hear is they present this to NASA, and the engineers say, no, this will never work, you can't test it, there's not enough design in it that's based on old stuff, and then these guys say, oh, those NASA stodgy engineers, stick-in-the-mud kind of guys, and it has all of the marks of a conspiracy theory, like 9/11 or something like that, you know, it's like big pharma, this is big NASA, you know, right. suppressing the little guy sort of thing, and you know, I don't know if that's right or not, but it just listening to this whole story was making me laugh. I actually have no idea if their idea has merit or not.
But it doesn't sound like, from what you're saying, that they're putting forward a compelling case to the space community.
Oh, I don't know. I just all I've heard is that they showed it to NASA and NASA said no way.
Okay.
And even if it's a good plan, knowing NASA, you know, NASA runs just like a government agency. Imagine that.
Right.
And so, you know, they don't just stop on a dime and redesign everything from top to bottom. It takes years. That's why it's going to take that long to get Constellation up and running, to get these Ares rockets spaceworthy. And so you can't just say, oh, look, we have a better design. Let's go with this one. It's way too late for that.
Okay, so even if they have some good ideas, they're a day late and a dollar short, basically.
I think so.
Okay.
But I don't know. I'm not a NASA engineer.
Right. Also, recently put into orbit, what is the GOCE, which is a European Space Agency satellite, the Gravity Field and Steady State Ocean Circulation Explorer. Now, this is a very cool piece of equipment.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's cool. Even the design, it's long and sleek, and it looks like a rocket ship. It's like something right out of a science fiction show. It's so cool. What this does is it measures the Earth's gravity field. And this is tough to do. Gravity is a very weak force to measure. And for example, Newton's gravitational constant, which is sort of measures the magnitude of the Earth's gravitational field, isn't really well known to that many decimal places compared to like the speed of light, which is easy to measure. And that's because gravity is so weak. So what you do is you put a satellite in orbit around the Earth, and they have accelerometers in it that measure basically the strength of gravity. And as this thing orbits the Earth, these three different accelerometers in three different parts of the spacecraft, it's like 5 meters long, you know, 15, 16 feet, they measure the Earth's gravitational field at these three different spots simultaneously, and they can measure changes in it due to land masses, which are denser than water, for example. So over land mass, there's a little bit more gravity. the Earth's shape. It's not a sphere. It's an oblate spheroid, like a beach ball that somebody's sitting on, because the Earth is spinning, and so it's bulging at the equator. The moon and the sun pull on the Earth, and so their tidal bulges, those don't line up. And so the Earth is just this misshapen, weird thing. And they're trying to measure the gravitational field of this thing, to measure what's called the geoid, which is the three-dimensional shape where the gravity is equal all over that. It's called the equipotential sphere. And this tells you a lot about the density of the Earth, the way things are arranged on the Earth, and you can use that to measure ocean currents and atmospheric effects and all kinds of things. And it's cool. It's a pretty awesome machine.
And I hear that the it'll be able to measure the geoid of the Earth to an accuracy of 1 to 2 centimeters.
Yeah, that's right. So you know you're measuring something. It's you can almost think of it as like sea level. If the Earth were made of complete liquid, what it would look like if it were just sitting there. And yeah, it's going to measure that shape, those deformities, to about a couple of centimeters, which is pretty phenomenal. One of the cool things about this is that gravity is so weak that they have to put this thing in a really low orbit so that it's in a strong enough gravity field to measure it well. So it's only 160 miles above the Earth's surface, I think. It's something like that. 250 kilometers, I think. So is that 160 miles? I can never convert that quickly.
It's roughly.
And so it's really in the upper fringes of the Earth's atmosphere. It's very thin up there, but there is enough drag that it would lower this thing's orbit and it would burn up faster than it can do its mission. So it's equipped with an engine to keep it up in orbit. And it's actually one of these fancy schmancy ion engines.
Yeah.
Which uses very little fuel, but it uses an electrostatic motor to fling ionized atoms out the back of this thing at some tremendous velocity.
Yeah, it's xenon. Cool.
It's usually xenon, yeah. I assume that's what they're using here.
Yeah, that is. That's xenon.
Oh, okay, yeah. It's what the Deep Space One probe used.
Right.
Yeah, they've actually got a primary ion engine and a backup ion engine.
Cool. So they have twin ion engines?
Yes, evidently. Yeah. And that's awesome. Cool. These things are low thrust, but you can keep them running for months and just apply and a very, very low acceleration and keep this thing in orbit. It's very cool science.
Yeah. So from what I read, it'll keep it up in orbit for 20 months, then it will run out of fuel and rapidly, I guess, its orbit will decay and it'll come crashing down.
Yeah, it'll probably smack into somebody's house someplace.
Right, right.
Hey, do you think Google will come out with a Earth gravity map when all the data's in?
Sure.
Google geoid.
You guys can have who's that geoid segment on the show? I just love saying that. Who's that noisy?
Isn't that funny? It's very catchy. It's very catchy.
I just don't have that accent that you guys have. I have such a flat mid-Atlantic accent. It doesn't turn out right.
What are you saying? We don't have an accent.
You gotta have a drink first.
You gotta try it like this. You gotta go, who's that noisy?
I love all the different openings for that segment too. It cracks me up.
Yeah, hey, if people still send them in, we'll keep using new ones. So Phil, we were chatting before. You said that you had some feedback for us on a couple of recent astronomy items that we discussed. I think the two were the question about the odds of having a perfect eclipse, that the apparent size of the moon would overlap with the apparent size of the sun.
Right.
And I think the other one was what would happen if there were no moon. Those are two discussions that we had recently. So what are your contributions to that?
Well, I'll take the second one. We'll do this in reverse order, just like you do in science or fiction. If the Earth had no moon, the discussion you guys had was pretty good. We wouldn't have tides. There would be an effect on the atmosphere. The Earth would be very rapidly rotating because the tides from the moon slow the Earth's rotation. We would still have tides from the sun, which are about half as strong as the moon. You guys got all that stuff right. That was pretty good. All I really want to add to that is that there's a book by Neil Comins, and that's C-O-M-I-N-S, called What If the Moon Didn't Exist? And it's an interesting book. It's got a lot of stuff in there, basically, if the moon didn't exist, or if the Earth were closer to the sun or farther, what it would be like. And so it's kind of interesting. And about the first thing you guys were talking about a creationist, and I've heard this argument a million times too, you know, obviously the moon was put at just the right distance from the Earth so that it was the same apparent size as the sun, and we'd be the only planet in the solar system that gets a perfect solar eclipse. Therefore, God exists. And, right. You know, whether or not you believe God exists, that's a really bad argument. As Steve pointed out, the moon actually orbits the Earth on an ellipse, and the Earth orbits the sun in an ellipse. So sometimes the moon looks bigger, sometimes it looks smaller, same with the sun. And so if the moon is particularly close to the Earth when the Earth is particularly far from the sun, then the moon covers more than just the sun. It blocks some of the corona. And if the moon is farther away and looks smaller, and the moon in the Earth is closer to the sun and the sun looks bigger, you get an annular eclipse where the moon doesn't cover the entire sun. And so you don't get an eclipse really at all. You don't see the corona at all. And there are times you do. And the other point is that, as you guys pointed out, the moon is moving away from the Earth at about 4 centimeters a year because of tides. Rebecca, actually, you got that number right. So there you go.
Hang on a second, Phil. Because Bob and I had a conversation about this, because we both looked it up to try to clarify. And I still find different numbers for the rate at which the moon is moving away from the Earth. But here's the thing. I think that we're quoting two different numbers. The rate at which the moon is moving away from the Earth today, which I think everyone agrees is that 3.8 centimeters or 4 centimeters. And the average rate at which the moon has been moving away from the Earth over the last, whatever, 3 billion years.
And that's an important point, actually.
Yeah.
Because moving away from the eclipses, the creationists like to say, if the Earth were old, and you take the rate the moon is moving away from the Earth now, and you extrapolate it backwards, it would have been in contact with the Earth, you know, 10 million years ago or whatever the number is, but not 4.5 billion years ago, which is how old the moon is. So clearly, those you know, atheist astronomers have this wrong. But that's wrong, because the moon's recession from the Earth changes. Mm-hmm. The moon is moving away from the Earth because it's slowing the Earth's rotation. Basically, the Earth's rotational energy is being given to the moon's orbital energy, and that moves the moon away. It's a long, complicated thing. If you search on bad astronomy moon tides on Google, you'll find a whole essay I wrote on this, long description of how this all works.
Right.
But it's really cool, because it all fits together so well. It's great.
A good way to look at that, though, the reason why the moon's moving away is that the tidal bulge of the Earth near the moon and the moon itself are kind of like attracted to each other, which kind of speeds up the moon in its orbit. And if you're in an orbit around a body and you move faster, you have to get into a higher orbit.
That's
how orbital mechanics works. That's just another way to look at it as to why it's moving away. And of course, the opposite reaction, the Earth is slowing down because it's tugging on that tidal bulge, which is kind of increasing the friction of our rotation, and that's slowing us down. So it's just another way to look at it.
That's right. And in fact, it's how well the tidal bulge of the oceans moves around the Earth that is coupling the moon to the Earth's energy distribution. And so, in other words, as the Earth is slowing, it's giving that energy to the moon, and it depends on how that water flows around. That is the efficiency of that system. And exactly. Right now, that system is really efficient. And so the moon is moving away faster than it did in the past. Although, if you just naively look at the equations, as the moon gets farther away from the Earth, that recession rate should drop. So in other words, a million years ago, the moon should have been moving away faster. But in fact, it wasn't, because there's more detail to it. See, this is very confusing.
It is.
And so basically right now, the bottom line is the moon is moving away faster than it used to. And so you can't just naively backtrack using that 4 centimeters a year now. But the point is, it is moving away. And so you can say to yourself, at some point in the future, the moon will be so far away, it'll be too small to block the sun completely, and we will no longer have a total lunar eclipse. And if you do the math, and I did it pretty simply myself, the equations aren't that tough, I got about 1 billion years from now, something like that. It could be less, but it's something like 1 billion years. And you can say to yourself, well, at some point in the past, the moon was so close to the Earth that it blocked a lot of the corona. And if you do the math and just, make some rough estimates, it turns out that was about 1 billion years in the past. So basically right now, we're sort of in the middle of a 2 billion year eclipse season.
Mm-hmm. Well, how do you figure that?
Take the coefficient of the derivative and divide by.
Well, it goes as 1/r^6. I'll just leave it at that.
Is there ever going to be a time when the moon and the Earth aren't married to each other?
That's a good question. I don't know. And it gets to the point where, as the moon moves away from the Earth enough, will it be outside of the Earth's influence and become a heliocentric object? That calculation is pretty complicated. And I think the amount of time that takes, you actually have to start including the calculation that the sun is getting hotter and will get bigger and turn into a giant. Because I think it actually will take that long. But I don't know. And I don't know if anybody's ever actually done the full-blown calculation, because you actually have to worry about the gravity from other planets and all kinds of stuff, because little effects add up after, you know, 10 billion years or whatever it's going to take.
It's amazing how complicated these things get. And again, just to finish up on the rate that the moon's moving away from the Earth discussion. So the lower number, about what you said, 2 centimeters a year, Bob, that Bob quoted, was actually the average rate. Yeah. Whereas the 4 centimeters that Rebecca was quoting was the current rate. So that was the distinction. And yeah, I read the same thing, Phil, that it is that we're in a very efficient time, and that has to do largely with the arrangement of the continents.
Correct.
And so it's really continental drift that changes the rate at which the moon moves away from the Earth over, you know, geological time, which is really interesting. And who would have thought, you know, it was plate tectonics was affecting the rate at which the moon's moving away from the Earth.
But and in fact, the only reason we know the moon is receding from us is because the Apollo astronauts left retroreflectors on the moon that we can pulse laser beams at and measure the distance to the moon to an incredible accuracy. And then over time, you can see that the moon is receding from the Earth and measure it to, you know, an accuracy that is, you know, very small, so that you can see the moon is receding by the width of the, you know, the palm of your hand every year. It's incredible.
Or the speed of light slowing down.
Cool.
Well, that would fit in with the creationists as well. They say the speed of light is slowing down. That's why the universe is only 6,000 years old.
Someone is moving those reflectors a little bit farther away every year.
Oh, that could be. They're digging them into a hole 4 centimeters deeper every year.
Or the moon landing was a hoax.
You didn't hear that from me.
I read a book that said we didn't land on the moon.
As long as NASA keeps sending those paychecks to me, I'll keep saying we landed on the moon.
Yeah, right?
Absolutely. All right. Yeah, make sure we get our cut this week, right? So, Phil, thanks again for joining us. Always a good time.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
Thanks, Phil.
Thanks, Phil.
Have a good night.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with 3 science news items or facts, 2 real and 1 fake. And I challenge my expert skeptics to tell me which one they think is the fake. And you all can play along.
Tonight, no matter what I choose as the answer, make me pick a different one.
Okay.
Do you want to go first?
I'll go first.
Okay. But first, let me read you the actual items. Item number 1. A new study shows that project managers are more successful if they are feared by their team. Item number 2. New brain imaging study provides evidence that intelligence is largely genetic. Item number 3, paleontologists have discovered a new species of dinosaur half the size of a house cat. Jay, go first.
Okay, so a new study shows that project managers are more successful if they are feared by their team. Oh my God. Well, I've managed projects. I work under project managers. You know, more successful what? Like, what are you gauging? Like, the project gets done on time, it gets done better. I mean, I personally don't work well under people that I don't like, or if I have any reason to fear them, the job wouldn't last long to me. As opposed to what, Steve? As opposed to
not being feared?
And you got to give us more information on this one.
That's pretty self-explanatory. The degree to which the project manager was feared by their team is the variable, and then there were some outcome metrics that were used to decide to measure success.
Yeah, Jay, they meet their projects that they're on time and on budget. I mean, that's a good metric right
there. Well, I mean, I would say that for the most part that would be true, because if you fear if you don't have enough balls and you fear your boss, like, oh, I'm afraid of my boss or afraid of the project manager I'm working under, yeah, you'll work harder to not get them coming down on you. Okay. I just think it's kind of silly. Anyway, new brain imaging study provides evidence that intelligence is largely genetic. That is going to piss a lot of people off. Paleontologists have discovered a new species of dinosaur half the size of a house cat. All right. That's the one I want to pick as the fake. All right, so then now I'll go with the genetic intelligence one as the fake.
Don't do that.
Okay.
You should really pick the first one.
Yeah, I'll take the first one as the fake, Steve, the project manager's one.
Okay, Rebecca?
I'll go with the second one.
I didn't see that coming.
Wait, I'll go... I'll go through them real quick.
I like the moon.
I doubt that the project managers being more successful if they're feared does. I am skeptical of that because I react very negatively to anyone who makes me try to fear them. But that's a single data point. So I could see a study possibly showing that. And a new species of dinosaur half the size of a cat, that makes sense as well. I could see tiny. There have been small dinosaurs before, so that wouldn't be a huge shocker. But to say that intelligence might have some basis in genes, I think, has been put forward in the past, but it's always been a bit doubtful. There have been some studies that show it, but it's so wishy-washy that to say suddenly that it's largely genetic, I think, is doubtful. So I think that that is the fake news item. So, Jay, I don't know where you got your information, but I'm going to say that number two, the
okay.
False one.
Okay, Bob.
Yeah, I can't agree with you on that one, Rebecca. Well, let's take this in reverse order. The small dinosaur, yeah, that's pretty easy. There's been tons of small dinosaurs. So what? So this one's really tiny. I don't have a problem with that.
He left the moon.
The brain imaging that the intelligence is largely genetic. I think it depends on how you define largely. This seems like a no-brainer to me, so to speak. A no-brainer. Largely, isn't that what they've been saying for quite some time now? So maybe they really pinned it down and nailed it and said, "Yeah, this is really clearly more genetic than environmental." So I'm going to have to say that one's true. And one doesn't make that much sense to me either, so it's easy to say that one is fiction. Because I don't think necessarily because having your people wear that work under you, fearful of you, I don't think that necessarily is going to translate into success.
Hey, Bob, if you were a project manager, would you rather be feared or loved?
Is that a trick question?
No, it's a joke.
I think you just answered it, Bob.
Is it better to be feared or loved?
Or loved, yeah. Thank you, Steve. Wow, you guys are idiots.
So, Bob, your answer is the
project manager is
fiction. Okay. All right, Evan.
Oh, crud. Bob, you screwed me up now because I was really leaning towards this intelligence being largely genetic one is fiction. But now you got me thinking.
It's always bad to get Evan thinking. Sorry.
Don't get him thinking.
Damn
now.
You. This is not good. Oh, gosh.
Not good at all.
What to do?
If only you had inherited more intelligence.
Rebecca, you didn't change your choice, did you?
No.
No, she just after the
You're still going with You're still going with that intelligence largely genetic is bunk, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's my thought
join
too
my team.
And therefore I'm going to stick to my guns.
Okay.
Nice.
So
all right, you and me.
We're
Evan.
Split between
you and me.
The project managers and the intelligence being inherited. But you all agree that paleontologists have discovered a new species of dinosaur half the size of a house cat.
Yes.
And that is science.
Okay.
And that's not that big a deal.
Tiny
it is
dinosaurs.
Pretty cool, but not as you got, it's not actually the smallest dinosaur ever discovered. This is the smallest dinosaur discovered in North America. It is Hesperonychus, or Hesperonychus, depending on your preference. It's a small two-legged dinosaur that probably hunted small animals, insects, maybe small mammals.
Squirrels.
This is in a group of bird-like dromaeosaurs known as the Microraptorinae, or Microraptors.
Ooh.
Pretty cool. And the interesting thing here is that paleontologists are beginning to think that there were probably a lot more tiny dinosaurs than we currently know about. That the image of all dinosaurs being huge may not be accurate. In any ecosystem, there's usually large predators, and the large predators are significantly outnumbered by small predators. So why would not that be true also for the dinosaurs? Where are all the small dinosaur predators? This is clearly one.
The big predators ate them?
Well, they think it may just be an artifact of the fact that larger animals are more easily fossilized and found. You know, that is just a...
Yep.
A bias in how we are discovering them and how easy it is for them to get fossilized. But if we look, they're out there.
Maybe Satan just didn't bother burying
those.
That's
true. That's possible. All right, so I guess we'll go to number one. A new study shows that project managers are more successful if they are feared by their team.
It's looking
good,
Rebecca.
And that one is fiction.
Oh, yes.
Oh, like a knife in my heart. God, that must,
just, now, Rebecca, quick, tell us for history's sake, how does it feel to really be stupid?
Well, you can't blame me. Well, blame my parents.
That's right.
As the new Minister of Guessing for Canada, Rebecca Watson.
In fact, the study shows that project managers who are nice and who are well-liked by their team are more successful.
Yeah.
And so you guys actually hit upon the reasons, and in your feelings, your experience is generalizable, that project managers who were thought by their team to be honest and kind and who thought that they were treated with respect had a better working relationship, and they that resulted in the project running more smoothly, being more efficient. They also noted that there is the specific psychological effect they say is at work here is, of course, the psychologists always have to come up with really complicated terms for things. So they call this the interactional fairness perception effect. So if you perceive that your interactions with your boss and with other people are fair, then you are going to behave that way too. And they say that the interactional fairness perception affects cross-functional communication. So basically, if you think you're being treated well, you're going to work well with others on your team. They also pointed out that this phenomena works in lots of places. For example, if you are a purchaser and you have even a minimal personal relationship or contact with your suppliers, you'll get a better price for things, for example. All of this means that new brain imaging study provides evidence that intelligence is largely genetic, is science. And this, you guys are correct in that this is not exactly new news, the notion that there's a genetic component to intelligence. It has been controversial, though there are many people, neuroscientists, who think that it's more controversial than it needs to be, that the controversy is largely political and not scientific. But what this is a new line of evidence. And it's interesting. It's a multi-step thing. It was actually an interesting sequence. What they were looking at was the speed at which water diffuses through the brain with a very, very high resolution.
What does that have to do with intelligence?
No. It actually correlated with the speed with which signals travel through axons, right? So at the resolution that they were doing it and the way they were imaging the movement of fluid through the brain, they were actually able to infer from that the relative speed with which axons were conducting signals.
So in this case, intelligence is judged by how quickly...
Hang on. I said this was a multi-step situation.
Okay.
That, in turn, is determined by the efficiency and the thickness and the robustness of the myelin, which is the insulation around the axons, around the nerves, which in turn is determined by genetics, by various genes. They also correlated this speed of conduction with the robustness with which the different parts of the brain communicated with each other, and therefore overall processing speed. So probably the most problematic word in the sentence that I used was the word intelligence, because that is a very broad concept. There's lots of different things that go up to make intelligence, but in this context, it was essentially overall processing speed of the cortex. They did do these studies in to sort out the genetic component of it. They did it in fraternal and identical twins. Fraternal twins share 50% of their DNA. Identical twins share 100% of their DNA. So there they were able to look at the influence of genetics on this measure of brain processing speed. And they showed that there was a dominant genetic contribution to that.
So, meaning that the identical twins
The identical twins were more alike than the fraternal
than
twins.
Than the fraternal.
Yes, that's right.
How sure are we about those correlations? It seems like there were a couple of jumps in there that make things more complicated.
Yeah, well, that's a good question. Always, the difference between correlation and causation. There's certainly a plausible cause and effect there. the speed with which processing occurs and the speed with which you can think and information and pattern recognition can occur inside the brain. The other piece of evidence they talk about is the fact that intelligence follows kind of a U-shaped curve as we get older. You know, we sort of peak in our measures of intelligence in middle age, and then as we get older from there, our cognitive function actually declines, and the speed with which neurons conduct also track the same way, so they follow the same trajectory. Therefore, that's a pretty good correlation between this processing speed and measures of intelligence, so it's reasonable to infer that their two things have a meaningful relationship. It's not just a coincidence.
All right, I guess I'm ready to admit that Jay got it right.
Jay did get it right. Your strategy worked, Jay. You did the Costanza strategy, right?
Yeah.
Go with your gut instincts and then pick the opposite.
Well done.
Right. Good work.
Thank you. Thank you. That's good work, boys.
So, Evan.
Who's that noisy?
Who's that noisy?
Play for us the Who's That Noisy from last week, and then tell us what the hell it was.
All right, folks. Here it is.
Evan, can I guess? Can I guess, Evan?
Yeah, go ahead.
All right, this is what my guess was last week when I heard it. It sounds like a piece of wood with a metal in it that's used to simulate bird calls.
Wow, no. But that's a good guess.
I think it's some kind of animal.
Yes, and that was actually the guess of someone.
Is that right?
Some kind of animal.
And you, didn't you say it had to be really specific?
Christopher said... Yes, that was just it, because I didn't want to hear that, animal or even monkey.
Organism.
Right, because it was a monkey. I wanted to know what kind of monkey. I think this was the hardest Who's That Noisy yet, and yet somebody got it right.
Really?
A spider monkey.
Oh, spider monkey.
A spider monkey. So this person knew their spider
monkeys.
Sounded
like a bird to me.
From the message boards, Furious Six Claws McGee.
McGee.
That's a good name. Congratulations.
Has three posts, and one of them is the correct answer to this week's Who's That Noisy. So, well done. I'm very impressed.
Yeah, me too.
I'll be even more impressed with whoever can name this week's Who's That Noisy. Here it is.
As a NASA employee performing climate change research during the Clinton-Gore administration, I was told what I could and could not say during congressional testimony. Since it was well known that I was skeptical of the view that mankind's greenhouse gas emissions are mostly responsible for global warming, I just assumed that this advice was to help protect Vice President Gore's political agenda on the subject.
That's definitely a bonobo.
That's Phil Plait, right?
It did sound like Phil.
Sound a little like Phil. But it was not Phil Plait. But good luck, everyone.
Thank you.
Jay, give us a quote.
Okay, guys, I have a quote. This quote was sent in by Sean Rafferty. So this is a quote by Frank Herbert, who was the critically acclaimed and commercially successful American science fiction author. He wrote the Dune saga, everybody.
We like the Dune!
Everyone would be familiar with that. And Frank said, "The beginning of knowledge is the discovery of something we do not understand." Frank Herbert!
An awesome series. There's a lot of good skeptical philosophy woven into that series, actually, if you read deeply into it.
And Sting.
And his son wrote a prequel series, actually, with another author.
Yeah, they were great, too.
Not quite as skeptical as the father, unfortunately. I was disappointed. He whipped out the 10% of the brain thing at one point. I'm like,
Oh, no.
I remember that.
Acorn
has fallen far from the tree.
That's
come on.
We are disappointed, Bobby Herbert. What was this? I don't know.
So don't forget to sign up for TAM, for the amazing meeting. You really have to go. And Science-Based Medicine Conference on July 9th, the Thursday before TAM. It's going to be a hoot. And if you happen to be in the medical profession, you can get CME for it. So sign up for that as well.
Yeah, and kids, don't do drugs.
And don't do drugs. And stay in school, please.
Oh, yeah.
And don't, please do not appoint creationists to science ministerial positions.
Don't
please.
Do that.
And wear condoms.
Wear condoms.
Wear those condoms.
And pull up those baggy pants.
Yeah,
nobody wants to see
baggy
your freaking underwear.
And belts
I can't
that are
deal
like,
with
you know,
that.
Please take the cell phone off your belt.
Don't
just
wear woven
belts
Quiet,
and have them hang down to your knee. How about that?
And what's with that hat all sideways and cocked? And what?
And get off my lawn.
Wear a hat like a normal person, please.
Yeah, get a job.
And never forget, the internet is for porn, so grab your dick and double click.
Oh, my God, Bob. That's awesome, Bob.
Wow. Did not see that coming.
This new segment's called Who's That Bitchy?
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and SkepChick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.